Hey, this is David. Welcome back to the Role Models Podcast. This is a really quick brief message before we continue to this week's episode. And this is a great episode, I can promise you that. I have a question for you. Would you like to become a supporter of the Role Models Podcast and directly contribute to making it possible for us to create the podcast? If your answer is a big yes, then that's great news because we're excited today to introduce a new way for you to support the creation of the Role Models Podcast. And the way it works is with a service called Patreon. Patreon is a membership service that lets fans contribute a dollar amount of their choice, in return receive a small reward, and thereby help creators find sustainable income for the work that they create. And this is how it works. Your listeners can go to our page on patreon.com/role models. You can choose from one of the four tiers and rewards, and we have rewards between $1, $3, $5, or $10 per episode. And every time we publish a new episode, you get charged for the tier that you selected. For example, if you select the $5 reward, it means that every time we publish a new episode, your name and link to your website or social media profile of your choice will be included in the description of the podcast episode. And in addition, we will follow you on Twitter and also tweet a little shout out. So if this is something that you want to look into, we would love for you to explore our new page on Patreon, patreon.com/role models. You may, of course, continue to enjoy the podcast for free by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud. And we do hope that in addition, you have a look at our new page on Patreon and consider supporting us with some of your hard-earned monies. If you do so and become a patron today, this is a big shout out on this end. Thank you for being an early supporter and enjoy this new episode of the Role Models Podcast. Thank you. Hey, and welcome to the Role Models Podcast. My name is David Noel. We are back after a short summer break with a brand new episode of the Role Models Podcast. And it's a podcast where I interview successful and inspiring women about their life and career and what they have learned on their journey. Today's guest has been a guest on three of my favorite podcasts. She's been a guest on the Tim Ferriss Show, on the Ezra Klein Show, and she's been a guest on Pod Save America. And today, I'm really excited that she's the guest on the Role Models Podcast. Her name is Kara Swisher. She's one of the most prominent and respected journalists in the tech industry, and she's known for her insightful reporting, straight-shooting style, and hard work ethic. Kara Swisher is the co-founder and executive editor of technology news website Recode. She's the host of the Recode Decode podcast, and she's the co-executive producer of the Code Conference. Kara has interviewed thousands of people over the course of her career as a journalist. She interviews hundreds of people every single year, so it was obvious that we talk about her tips on how to become a really great interviewer, or what it was like to interview presidents like Barack Obama, or candidates for presidency like Hillary Clinton, or media-trained tech business executives like Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, or Steve Ballmer. We talk about the recent events in Silicon Valley and the stories about sexism in high-profile companies in the industry, about what leaders in those companies ought to be doing, and what else needs to change culturally. We talk about what it was like to deal with a stroke, how to become a little bit more selfish, and how to focus on what truly makes you happy, and about how she thinks about mentors and role models. We've received some really great feedback about this podcast, some great reviews on iTunes, so we really appreciate your support. If you are a regular listener and have taken a time in the past to rate and post a review on iTunes, I salute you and we thank you. This is the Role Models Podcast. My name is David. This is episode 16, and here's my guest, Kara Swisher. Kara Swisher, thanks for coming on the podcast.
No problem.
This is a 12 hours ago. I didn't know this was happening.
Oh,
you
okay.
Didn't know this was happening.
So
appreciate
Thank you, Eric Anderson.
The fast yes. Mm-hmm. for taking the time.
I had no choice, so.
Sorry?
I had no choice, so here I am. Okay. Eric is very persuasive.
Kara, my first question would be, I want to jump straight into it. I'm listening to a podcast right now, which is fairly new. It's called The Turnaround, and it's hosted by Jesse Thorne. And he, in this podcast, he interviews interviewers. So really to look at what are the pro tips professional interviewers can share. And so in two episodes, there's one guest, Susan Orlean, staff writer for New Yorker, who shares that she never prepares for an interview.
And then
you have a recent one, the current one, which is with Audie Cornish, All Things Considered. She says it's a pet peeve when people are not prepared. So my first question to you would be, like, how do you prepare for interviews?
I'm with Susan Orlean on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I don't say I don't prepare. I know people I'm talking to because I've been covering them all year. I'm a year-long reporter, and so I spend all my year knowing what everybody's doing. So it's not like I'm unprepared. I just think that over-preparation for interviews is the death knell of them. I think people don't have conversations. You can't lead the conversation in a different direction depending on what someone says. You're not listening because you're trying to get whatever point you want to make in. And it's not, I think an interview is a process of discovery and surprise. And so I think you can't be surprised if you're prepared and you have a list of questions. But I certainly know the people. I mean, I'm very prepared in life. And I, you know, when I'm interviewing, say, when I was interviewing Steve Jobs, I knew all about his history. It's not that I knew what he was up to that year or recently, say, Hillary Clinton, I was certainly very aware of what she'd been doing. So I go where the conversation leads, because I think that's a really, I definitely set up questions to get to somewhere. But I don't set up questions for gotchas. I don't set up questions for winning points. I'm trying to have an entertaining time for myself, like, to entertain myself.
And have you found a way to go on effective discovery on that journey in an interview? Like, what are practical ways to do that?
Well, I'm a really good interviewer. I am. I haven't gotten to be very good. I do a lot of them. I do my podcast now. So I do hundreds of interviews a year now. So you start to get good, you know, practice makes perfect kind of thing. But I think what I do is I ask what people are thinking in their head. I'm not scared to ask I don't say the tough questions necessarily, although sometimes they are, but they're the questions everybody wonders about. Like, what's it like to be Hillary Clinton? How do you like half the country hating you? You know, that kind of stuff. And so I think I also try to ask intelligent questions. I know it sounds dumb, but I think smart people like smart questions. I always say that. And I think it's true is that, you know, everyone's like, aren't people scared to be interviewed by you? There's some reputation I have of being a scary interview, but that's not the case. I think really smart people like to be challenged because they don't get challenged all day. Most of the people I cover are lauded all day. They get kissed up and down. They get treated with deference. And I think they enjoy someone who's questions because it makes them think about what they're doing and makes them question and maybe do a better job. I think it helps a lot of the only people that don't like my interviews are people who have something to hide. So, they're not smart. They're just not smart and they can't keep up.
So, walking over here, I was thinking about, like, what is something that I know of Kara Swisher, even though we haven't
probably
met
not
in
much
person.
In Germany.
And,
I'm not sure if I'm so big in Germany, but okay.
But I listened to the podcast.
Israel. If it was Israel, you'd know all about me. The Israelis, all the techies.
So one of the things that came to mind was that, I see you as a fearless person, and you come across as a fearless person.
Sure.
And in reality, we all work with fears. We all have our fears. Mm-hmm. So my question would be, when and through what process did you become fearless, if you can identify yourself as fearless?
I can. I'm not scared of very many things. I mean, I'm scared of normal things, like, you know, falling off bridge or something like that, like that you should be scared of, although I'm not particularly scared of falling off a bridge. I think that... I was like that since I was born. I think I've always been the way I am. And I never felt nervous about anything. I never did. I think it's genetic. I don't know if it is genetic, but I think it was my personality trait to be bold. I think I've told this story before, but when I was a baby, they called me Tempesta because bold. They were always using that term for me, bold. You're so bold. You're such a stormy, you know, kind of personality. It's actually, they're words used to make women feel less, you know, like, don't be so loud. And I wasn't loud particularly, actually. Don't be so bold. I remember hearing that a lot when I was growing up from teachers and others. And I was like, what's wrong with that?
What would you say if you would have to share a piece of advice. So you say it's, you were born that way.
Be bold. Yeah. Bold. I think people get pushed down by words. They get pushed down by actions, and especially women. And it never worked on me. You know, I think it works on a lot of people. Like, get along, be cooperative, be nice, smile. I don't not smile. I just don't like being told to smile. And so I think it was interesting. I remember when I was very young, I was quite smart for a kid. Everyone caught up with me, but as a kid, I could read really early. I wasn't a genius, but early on, I was pretty far ahead of other kids in reading and comprehension and things like that. And I had finished the curriculum, like I had finished all the books. And my teacher said, you know, I got up and left the room, and she goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm just bored. I'm not going to sit here." You know, this is when I was young, and she's like, "You have to sit right back down." I'm like, "Why? I'm bored. Like, why would I sit here if I'm bored? I'm going to go find something else to do." And I remember the principal laughing, like, thought that was real funny, you know. And she was like, "How could you do that?" I said, "Well, why would I sit there? Why would I sit there and be bored?" And so I think I was able to articulate what other people felt and felt nervous to do it. And I never that's the same thing I do today. I say right out loud what I'm. You know, I don't like that, or I have a very good ability to articulate what I'm feeling verbally when other people sort of hold it back. And I don't think it's rude. I don't think I'm particularly rude to people. I just don't, like recently, we did a story about David Bonderman, the board member of Uber, who said that stupid thing on stage to Arianna Huffington during a he made a sexist joke in the middle of a discussion about sexism in the workplace. So it was like kind of stupid. And in my story, I said he had an apology. And I said, "I'm not even printing it. I don't want to hear it. Like, I don't want to hear." And I got a call from people at his company, and they're like, "You won't even print it?" I go, "No, I just don't want to hear it. Like, I'm sorry, I'm not printing your thing." And they're like, "Well, you have to." I go, "Well, I don't. It's my blog. I really don't." And they're like, "Well, don't you have to give him a chance?" I said, "I could, but I don't want to." And I was really applauded for that, because I was like, why should I listen to his stupid apology? I mean, I know we're supposed to, like, oh, you should let someone apologize. So I was like, why do we have to let someone apologize? So I think I do well in Silicon Valley because I'm constantly questioning why we do things. I think a lot of really good techies do that too. Why do we have the car system we have? Why do we have the photography system we have? Why do we have the entertainment system we have? So I'm good at that.
You mentioned that you conduct hundreds of interviews a year.
Now I do,
and the podcast. And that, yeah, with the podcast
and the stage stuff. We do a ton of
and on stage on the conference, mm-hmm. The conference. Yes, you said that a way for you to be an effective interviewer is by knowing people, by knowing the story, by following the story,
sure.
So, and by building relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And what have you found to be effective ways to build a relationship that that navigates this balance between
right.
Wanting to hear the story, but also not to just be a channel, a PR
right.
channel.
Sure, like, yeah, absolutely. I'm not a PR channel. I don't think I'm known for that. One of the things that helps with interviews, I think, of my interviews are really good, is because I've known a lot of these people for a long time. Like, I really know Mark Andreessen. We've known each other since he was very young, and I was very young. I've known Mark Zuckerberg since he started, and you can go through the whole panoply of people I cover. So I tend to have very good interviews because I have an intimate, really, I don't mean to say intimate, but I've known them for a long time. So they don't start with their tricks. Everyone has tricks of conversation that they're trying to get through to you. And one of the best pieces of advice I ever got when I was a young reporter was, I used to think people would lie to me. Like, what are they lying to me about today? Like, what's the lie? And I think a lot of people lie to themselves. You know, what are they lying themselves about to get them through the day? And so I try to pierce that. Like, what do they need me to know about them? And I let them get that out of the way. Like, I'm the smartest person. I always have to be right. So everybody has, or a motivation of anger or whatever. So everyone has a motivation of themselves. And so once you get at that, you can have a really good interview. You figure out what that those people, how they need to communicate. And it's pretty quick. It's pretty quick when you figure it out. Like, when I was interviewing Barack Obama, one of the things I said right before the interview is I got a shorter interview time than other people. I don't know why, but I did. I was looking at some of his interviews, and he talks in paragraphs because he's the president. He gets to say whatever he wants. So, like, no one shuts him up, essentially. And a lot of them are meaningless. Like, a lot of his sentences are just words, like a lot of words. And I had a short time, so I didn't want him to do these lectures at me kind of thing. I wanted to have a conversation about encryption and all kinds. It was all about tech because it was a tech summit that he was at. And right before the interview, and I can't believe I did this, but I thought about it really carefully. And I said, listen, you tend to talk in paragraphs. I just told him. I said, you tend to talk in paragraphs because I guess no one ever interrupts you. I suppose that's why it happens. And you're used to it. It's 8 years now or whatever it was. And you're really used to talking and never stopping talking. And so I'm going to interrupt you a lot. So just get ready for that so you don't feel uncomfortable. I know you used to be able to have that happen to you and now you don't. So I'm going to do that because I have a short amount of time. And he goes, oh, I heard you were obnoxious. And now it's true. And I said, I'm not obnoxious. I'm just, you know, I mean, I just, he was trying to knock me off. What I found out about him when I was interviewing him, the answers he gave that were better, and he got annoyed by me. You could see him visibly annoyed by me. His answers were better when he was annoyed. I know it sounds crazy. Like, we had a back and forth about encryption where he said, I see reports every day and I know things you don't know. That's always the thing they always tell you. And I said, well, that's a shift from when you were running because you said this about encryption, which was opposite to what you're saying now, or very not the same. And he said, I never thought that. And I said, no, want me to read you the quote you said on the campaign trail? So I was real prepared for that, like that kind of thing. And he got annoyed. And then he gave a great answer on why his opinion changed. And so
that moment of annoyance, when you see in your interviewee, when you see that moment of annoyance, mm-hmm. what goes on? Like, do you go through that?
Yes. Yeah, I say, right, no, I don't agree with you. I think what I do a lot in interviews, not everybody responds to annoyance. Some people respond to humor. Some people respond. You have to figure out what the best conversational gambit works with people. Some people are very funny and they want to be funny, and I let them be funny, kind of stuff. Steve Ballmer is really funny, so I let him be funny. Like, and it was a better interview. And I also poked at him and got him to make jokes and stuff like that. I just, in the case of Barack Obama, he gives better interviews when he's annoyed. He just does. I could see it. Like, you could see him give really clear. He gets very clear. And I think one thing I do is when someone gives an answer, I'm like, that's not the answer. Like, you didn't answer the question. And I think people get uncomfortable by that because they know they didn't. Like, you know what I mean? Because they're very adept. Most of these people are super smart and they're very adept at avoiding answers. And so, you know, or they'll say something and I'll go, that's not true. And they know I know just as much as they do. So they tend to not keep up with whatever lie they happen to be. I don't call it a lie, but you know what I mean? How people talk to their own advantage. And so I tend to go, no. And then they what next? That's what's interesting part of an interview is what's next after the no, I don't believe you, or that's not true, or I know what you're saying, but I don't think you believe that. So I do a lot of that.
So you come across as
that's why they think it's fearless or rude, or I don't think that is. I just challenge.
I don't see this as rude. Mm-hmm. It's just the way to get through the challenge, mm-hmm. right? And I think mm-hmm. one of the things that I admire about you. You know, following the podcast, watching all the videos mm-hmm. of the conference and, mm-hmm. and reading your blog is you come across as raw and authentic and, mm-hmm. and real, mm-hmm. which are qualities that we get taught as leaders in companies, right? Yeah. So we these are keywords that are very en vogue right mm-hmm. now. And on the other side, there's this maybe triggered by, sustained by social media, is this almost like this like 24-hour outrage cycle. Yeah. In addition to the news cycle, but the outrage, like, what is the next thing I can get outraged about?
So, I agree.
What we have is now, on the one hand, you have people who are less raw, less mm-hmm. less real, less authentic, mm-hmm. out of fear mm-hmm. of outrage, and on the other hand, we have people waiting for the next outrage.
Yeah,
how do you reconcile that?
They can't shut up. No, it's true. I think it's born by Donald Trump. I think he's sort of unleashed. I think it started with Twitter and other places where people feel they can say whatever they want. The problem with Twitter originally was anonymous, so people feel emboldened to be an asshole when they're anonymous. I think I don't like anonymousness at all online. I see why people do it, but people show their worst tendencies because they don't want to take responsibility for what they're saying. So I never encourage it. Now he's moved it to a new, he doesn't mind the outrage. He doesn't mind being spurring reaction. Sometimes I think he's fucking with people. He's just trolling, essentially. And he's real good at it. So then people respond. I can't believe he said that. Like at some point during the election or the campaign, someone was like, I can't believe he said that. I said, why not? He says it every day. Like, why can't you believe it? What day are you going to believe that he's going to say something, some asshole to every day? He does that. That's his thing. And what's fascinating is that people keep biting. Like, oh, again, like this last CNN thing where he had the CNN, Reddit, whatever, wrestling, punching.
The wrestling piece?
I decided I'm not coming. It's wrestling. I know what he's doing. And I know all his little constituents, all his little Trumpkins are like, oh, they don't know wrestling. Those elites don't know wrestling is just fake. Like, so I refuse to, like, I'm not even giving, oh, violence against the press, I guess. But you can't win with these people. So I suspect probably there will be violence against the press. That will happen. But I think that... it seems like that. It's building that way. But you just can't be outraged by him anymore. I think it's time to stop being outraged by him. I think it's probably a more effective way to live.
If you look at, you mentioned the board member of Uber early on, mm-hmm. and as I'm, you know, there's a lot of talk right now in the, you know, in Silicon Valley about the, you know, the topic around diversity, mm-hmm. and investors behaving wrongfully towards women, mm-hmm. and so it's the more and more right. topics like this emerging. I want to talk a little bit about how do you to frame it more around qualities of a leader. Like, mm-hmm. what do you see missing qualities of leadership coming out of our industry, the tech industry, or even geographically out of Silicon Valley? Like, what is something that you still miss there in terms of really moving?
Well, I think
moving forward.
I think the way people behave there is a lot of reasons. One is that they haven't been told to stop. That they are their leaders. And in the case of Uber, the reason there's so much sexual harassment is because the leaders encourage it and participate in it. You know what I mean? Like a lot of them do. I think if that happens, you get signals from your leaders and you say, "Hey, I'm not going to get in trouble for this. They're doing it." I think that's one issue. Another issue is that they. You know, they don't. No one ever said to stop. Like, what are you doing? What do you think you're doing? I mean, honestly, it goes back to being raised, but that's a whole other issue about how men are perceived, how women want to be spoken to, and everything else. And that's a whole bigger societal issue, I think. But I think that they, you know, we've done a lot of that reporting. We've gotten a lot of people fired at Uber, we didn't get them fired. Their behavior got them fired. We pointed it out, I think. And, you know, obviously Susan Fowler's blog post was super. I think what she did, even though there'd been several cases before, which were very awful, too, was that she was almost surgical in the way she took them apart. Like, she didn't. I hate to say it. She wasn't emotional about it. She's like, this happened, then this happened, then this happened, and this shouldn't happen. And it was. You couldn't argue with it. It was kind of like, all right, yeah, fair point. And I think that she, not that other people were too emotional or whatever, but I think she built a really great case of a culture gone bad in a way that the penny dropped for everybody. Like, they understood it. It seemed very true. It seemed very accurate, and nobody could deny. No one could say, oh, she's just being this or whatever. And so I read that piece a lot because I thought, what did she do here that created people to finally say, okay, this is a problem? And why was it this one over the 20 other crappy things that happened at Uber that managed to push it over the edge? I don't know what it is, but I think she just articulately and surgically took apart an issue and made it almost unemotional. I hate to say that because I think you should be emotional about issues like this, but I think she really was quite deft in how she presented what was a terrible situation.
What is something companies need to do? Like, if you could ask companies to do 1, 2, 3 things to move forward on that.
Well, you know, stop pretending it doesn't exist. Like, they like to say, you know, it's an aberration. I think one thing is they have to have systems in place. And you're not going to get rid of sexual harassment. It's just never going to. I'm shocked if it ever happens. You don't stop it. Every single company in all across the world, every government has sexual harassment problems. The issue is, how do you deal with it? How do you accept it and believe it? And put in systems in place to create a situation. You know, I've gotten a lot of emails lately, people like, this Google engineer said this to me, this said this. And I thought, I can't go after every asshole. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I can't, like, catch. What you have to go after is systematic assholes. Like, this recent story around 500 startups. This was someone who was doing something over a period of time in the same pattern kind of stuff. And so, you know, there's versions of these guys everywhere. It's just get the ones that are really egregious, and then it'll serve as a warning for the others to dial back on their behavior. Put in systems in place. Articulate from the very top that there's zero tolerance for this kind of thing. I mean, one of the things we wrote about was a memo that Travis Kalanick sent out to his staff about a party. And it literally, it had 9 HR violations in the first 10 sentences, essentially. And so, you know, he was encouraging partying. Now, I know it's nice to be fun, but he's the CEO, so someone else should encourage the partying. And so I think that you have, like, you have someone in the leadership that says, you know what, I'm a person, we all are people, but this is a workplace, and this is how we behave in the workplace. And not feel like you're like dampening the fun kind of stuff. But it's a workplace, it's not a fun place. And so workplaces can be fun. You can have a really nice time at work. There's a lot of people's social lives are wrapped up in work and everything like that. But there are certain strictures that women should be able to work without having to endure a pass if it's unwelcome. You know what I mean? It should be like basic. And it's so odd that it's even argued about. Like, I find it like, why would someone who is a professional want to be told their shirt looks good? Like, I'm not sure why people think that's okay. And then, of course, when you say something, they're like, well, I was just paying a compliment. It's like, that's not the compliment. They want a compliment on their work. They want a compliment on their accomplishments. And it's a really interesting, I have 2 boys, and so I think a lot about gender issues a lot, like how they talk to people, how they move about in the world. And I don't want, a lot of people talk, when Donald Trump on the pussy thing, when, you know, a lot of the male legislators said, well, as a father of a daughter, I really don't encourage this, you know what I mean, or whatever. I really condemn this. And most of them didn't condemn it enough. But as a father of a daughter, and I was like, what about as a father of a son? Like, do you want your son to talk like this? Do you want him to live in a world where this is acceptable behavior for him, or that this is how he should talk to women? Or, you know, it was just fascinating to me to be thinking about it. So I think that's, you have to put in place where everybody feels comfortable in an environment, not feeling like they're under a PC police, but feeling like this is how we behave, to treat each other with respect. And it's not PC to not say rude things to each other. It's respectful and kind and humane.
Yeah, those are the qualities that I would love to see emerging from those leaders as
well. Yeah, well, it would be nice, but most of them are narcissists in the extreme. So.
Kara, I heard you share in, I think it was Tim Ferriss's podcast, that you had a stroke 5 years ago.
I did. More than 5 years
now. More than 5 years ago. Yeah. And I was curious, like, the way you talk about your work and your life, and in this episode with Tim, particularly openly as well about challenges in your life, was there ever a moment where you didn't know what to do?
No. I'm supposed to say that. Yes, of course. I had these great moments. No, I honestly, I wish, you know, someone the other day was like, said something to me like, oh, you're a really great reporter. I go, yes, I am. Like, and I knew they got like, what? I was like, yeah, I am. You're right. You're accurate. That is correct. I'm probably the best tech reporter around. Like, and they were sort of like, there's other good ones, but I'm kind of the top. And they were sort of like, what? Like, how can you say that about yourself? I was like, well, it's accurate. And I think that. And so it was interesting to talk about when I was scared. I was definitely scared when I had the stroke. I think, I'll tell you, it was interesting. It's not that I was unaware of death, because my dad died when I was 5. So I've been very aware of death. And I'm sort of the Steve Jobs school of live your life like it's your last day. He gave that famous speech at Stanford, which I just read over and over again. I thought it was a wonderful speech.
That's a commencement speech
that he gave at Stanford. And he just, there was, every bit of it was fantastic. There was this really smart speech about using death as a motivator in life, which I think is common, but he just articulated it really well. And so I've been aware, I thought about that every day of my life since my dad died, which is most of my life. And so I think about how sudden things could happen, how suddenly you could die, how most people don't live, I don't say for the moment, but not aware. The awareness of death does promulgate a really good thing, is that you understand you have a limited time on the planet. So it's been a theme throughout my life, but not in a negative way, in a very positive way. And so I also don't spend time on the niceties of things. So why should I be scared of things? Why should I not be confident? Why should I not articulate myself correctly? And so I was scared. I was not scared when I had the stroke, because I know I have to die of something. Like, everybody has to die of something. What I was scared of, which was interesting, is I was fine when I was having it. I was fine when they told me about it. And then right after, for 1 minute, I was thinking of my children, that what it would be like for them without me there. And I remembered what it was like for me without my father. And so I think I was very upset about that. That's the only time I was scared, because I was like, I have to live because I don't want them to go through what I went through. And so, and I hadn't accessed those feelings ever, I think. It was really interesting. Like, I definitely hadn't accessed those feelings. And I think I teared up and I wasn't upset. And then I wasn't after that. I was fine. I dealt with all the stuff.
Did you put any big changes in place after that?
No, everybody wants you to, right? It's like,
yeah, no, it's a big, yeah. I lost my mom 4 years ago when I was age of 33. So a little bit older than you were. And that's for me, still, this was a bit of a reset.
Like
it's a set of emotions and feelings that you haven't been trained for. You haven't been, nobody can tell you what it's like until you experience it. And the concept of grief was foreign to me. I didn't know what it meant and how to deal with it. And then once you pass through these like event management type of like going through a funeral and all of these things, you're suddenly left with those things. Okay, so what does that even mean now?
Right.
Like for me. And so for me, I put things in place that really changed, not necessarily consciously, but so now in looking back.
No, I don't need big life events to do that. I do it all the time. Like when I left the Washington Post, I was writing a book about AOL, and I remember walking out of a meeting, an interview I was doing for the book, and I had been at the Washington Post. I was on a very good trajectory there, up to the top, you know, that kind of thing. And I wasn't quite, I remember looking around and not seeing anybody I wanted to be. And, you know, that sounds crazy, but I thought about that a lot, even when I was young. And I walked out of a beautiful day in New York on Park Avenue in a beautiful sky, and I thought, I'm leaving the Post. Like, I'm just doing it. I just do that all the time. It happens all the time with me. Or when I was leaving the Journal to do All Things D, I'm like, I'm doing it. I'm just doing it. I don't have a problem shifting. Even when I have tattoos, the day I got the tattoos, I'm like, today's the day. I'm going to do it. And I don't need like someone dying or a major illness. So I don't think I changed after the stroke. I just reinforced what I already thought about life, is that you have a limited time on this planet. You have to keep going. You have to move faster. And one of the funny things, I gave a pretty good TED talk on it, about the stroke, but everybody is like, now you'll have to slow down and enjoy life. I'm like, I do enjoy life. Like, I enjoy it fast. I'm going to work harder. Like, it was, or, you know, you won't, when you're on your deathbed, you won't think, oh, I'm glad I worked. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to think I'm glad I worked. I like my work. I'm sorry you don't like your work, but I love my work. It's passionate. And you should get a job where you like it, so that when you're on your deathbed, you're like, God, I'm glad I worked so
much.
What
is the thing that drives you there?
I just like it. I just like it. I found something I really liked. I think if you're lucky enough to find something, I'm very curious, and I'm never not interested. And by the way, the minute I'm not interested, I'll be gone. Like, I have a very good sense of that. Like, if suddenly I got, like, right now, Walt Mossberg just retired. You know, we've been doing the thing for 15, 16 years, essentially. And I'm thinking hard, like, oh, what do I want to do now? Like, what do I want to, like, I reassess almost constantly. And so I think, like, right now I'm like, shall I blow it up? Shall I do this? Like, my instinct is to change. So I don't mind that. And a lot of people don't like that. But
Is there something that you're learning right now that that you didn't know before? Something you want to get good at that you're not good at?
Relationships, probably. I'm in a relationship I really like right now, and I it's not the easiest one, but it's also great. It's like very challenging in a good way. I think that I didn't spend as much time thinking about that, like how you could be just as good at that as you are at your job.
Even though you're really good at establishing relationships.
I am. I've always been with people. No, with I've people. Had, no, you know what, I've been married. It was interesting. I was thinking, I've not been going out with someone since I was in sixth grade. Like, I have not been single, like, once in my life. And so that was an interesting thing to think about. Like, should I be in that? I'm like, no, I don't like being single. So I'm this way because I like this way. But I do think about like being better, like being better, making changes that are important, and not being stubborn. I think about that a lot more than I used to. And with my kids too, I spend a lot of time thinking about my relationship with my kids.
Where in the process of learning about relationships are you? And is there something you can share, some wisdom there already?
Like with my kids, I think a lot about, like, my son is turning 15. One of them is another's 12. They're very different challenges as kids. And I think I spent a lot of time thinking about how I put myself in their shoes, and I haven't done that as much as I should in my life. You know what I mean? I think it really makes me think hard about what they need, and you want them to grow up by themselves at the same time. You know, you don't want to like lead them everywhere. But I think a lot of, like, I'm very careful about what I say to them. Like, I'm not very careful about what I say, and I'm very careful about what I say to them, because I want them not to, I'm not careless with them. You know what I mean? Like, it sounds crazy, but I am very careful about how I speak to them, how I treat them, the responsibilities I give them. And I think a lot about it. And I didn't, I tend to do things off the cuff, and I think with them, I've changed. I prepare, I guess, a lot more. Like, how should I say this? Should I do this? Because I think it makes them better men. I'm very interested in making really good men. You know, I think it's a big responsibility to make good men, also good women, but I think particularly men that are kind and strong at the same time. And so,
do you have an example for something that you do to?
Yeah, one of my sons just had his first drinking incident. You know what I mean? Like, he's old enough. It happens. I shouldn't say this publicly. I guess, well, not too bad. Sorry, Louis. But, you know, it was minor. I didn't react badly. I was like, okay, I try to remember what happened to me. What is the appropriate punishment? How do you, you know what I mean? Like, both me and my ex, who is a fantastic parent, too, I think we were really good. I think we responded with the right amount of parental concern and not anger particularly, but, you know, discipline. And we were good. I think he learned a lot. We talked to him a lot about consequences. And I think that was a smart way. It wasn't being like parenting like 101, but it was like, let's talk about consequences, because that's what we thought what would affect him the most. So that we don't like scare someone away from something that's inevitable. Like, everybody drinks when they get older or they get drunk. Like, it's not, but it's more like, okay, this is what you did. It's probably a little early and here's why. And, but at the same time, not being like accepting that this was okay. Like, or a very similar thing happened with, some social media stuff with him. Every parent has that issue of kids violating social media norms that they shouldn't. And so we spent a lot of time talking about like that, like how he does that. Like, and my youngest is not on social media as much yet. But he also learns too. Like, we talked to him about that, like how you conduct yourself and stuff like that. So I think we spent a lot more time being super careful with them.
Yeah, particularly with social media, which was not something we grew up with.
No, exactly. But we're, you know, unfortunately for my both kids, both his parents are highly technical, so it's, they can't really trick us, right?
Yeah.
Oh, mom, we know everything. We're like, we know. Like, that's hard for both of them, because they can't pull the wool over our eyes in technology.
I've heard you say that you've had great mentors in the past, and this is a role model podcast, so I would love to, if you could share a little bit about the impact or the influence that role models or mentors have had on your life.
Critical.
And what are some things transferable that people listening to this be like, okay, so I'm at this early stage of my career, I'm seeking out mentors, or I have these role models. What do I do with this urge of learning from them, or even establishing relationship with a mentor?
I think the first thing is look around your work and see who you want to be. Like, is there someone you want to be like, or a job that you want? I think people don't do that a lot. I think people go through their lives, I use this expression a lot, like a menu, like, you know, the chicken or the fish or the duck or whatever it is. And like, what if you don't want those? What if you want beef? It's not on the menu. Like, people can like, oh, that's the next thing. And it's not just in jobs. It's like, oh, I met this person, so I guess it's time to get married. They don't think enough. Like, they don't, like, they just do the next thing. And especially women, they do that a lot more than men. I think they don't make choices. They make the choices in front of them versus then they think it's a choice, but in fact it's a rolling bunch of selections versus I want to do this. And I think one of the things I've done successfully is like, I don't want to be at newspapers anymore, I want to do this. Like, and I think people don't, they just sort of accept the next thing. That's one thing, is do I really like this? Is this what I really want to be doing? I had a woman come to me when she was at a career juncture. I'm not a mentor to her, but she'd been offered four or five jobs, and she's like, I was offered this, 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 and this. And I said, what do you want to do? And she goes, well, this one's interesting. I said, no, I didn't ask you about the ones that were offered to you. I'm asking you, what would you like to do? And I think she had never thought that way. She was just, whatever's offered to her is what her choices are. And I'm always like, what are your other choices that you don't, or what are the things you want to do that it maybe isn't offered to you? And so I think like that a lot. And so I'm not sure where I learned that, but I certainly think.
Is there a model to think about this? Is it like, template?
Just like, stop menu. Stop with the menu. Like, what do you want to eat? What do you, you know what I mean? Like, be a little selfish. Like, what makes you happy? Like, because I think if people are always like, I don't want to be selfish. I'm like, well, why not? Because if you're selfish, by the way, me being selfish has created dozens of jobs. So, you know what I mean? Like, what I wanted to do created a business with Walt that created lots of jobs. So I think it's good to be selfish. And I don't mean selfish in an icky way. I mean, selfish is what makes you happy? What makes you get up in the morning? And I think that's what I mean when I say selfish. It's like, think about what is good for you. And when it's good for you and you're happy, it's usually good for other people. It usually turns into positive things for other people. So that's one thing. And I don't know where I learned that. I don't think I learned that anywhere. I just was like, I've always been pleasing myself, essentially. Or being articulate enough to say, I don't like that. Like, I don't like this. I don't like being here. I've been able to get up and leave very easily, which I think is a good quality. And then in terms of mentorship, of course, Walt Mossberg has been amazing to me. I met him at a point where he was high above me on the shelf of career. And he really was incredibly generous with his time and attention. And we built something together that was great. And I helped him, too. But he always lived in abundance, which I think most people live in scarcity. Like, I got mine. Like, it's such an American trait, too. I got mine. I'm holding mine. And the people that are really successful are abundant. Like, they're open-handed, and they give away things. And in doing that, they get a lot more. I know it sounds like a Thanksgiving commercial, but they really do. People who are very generous with their time, I do it a lot. I give people time. Not everybody, but it's, for example, I spend any time, not any time, but as many times as I can. A young woman wants help or something like that. I tend to help women more than men. I hate to say that, but they need more help. They just do. Or a women's group wants me to speak, or I'll do it like in 2 seconds, because I feel like you have to like give people just one little extra moment kind of stuff. I ran into someone the other day. It was funny. I don't even remember this meeting. It was a reporter who was on CBS Now. It was like, oh, you changed my life with this lunch. I don't even remember the lunch. Like, I just had lunch with her, and I was like, you shouldn't do that. That sounds stupid. Like, I just gave her unsolicited advice, probably stupid. And she's like, I never had thought like that. And I just did this, and you changed everything. And I was like, oh, okay. Sounds good. Like, glad. She's like, I owe this to you. I'm like, no, you don't. You owe it to yourself. But I think, like, in moments where you can give people good advice, it really does help them more than you think.
Yeah, and you're being very generous with your time right now. So thank you for that. And we have two more questions, okay. And then we need to wrap up.
Yes, I'm catching a flight back to New York.
Yeah. What would you say is one foundational skill that you would advise people to develop and master early on in a career, mm-hmm. which will be beneficial and crucial to them throughout their career, regardless of the job?
Well, it's interesting, because being here in Germany, I was thinking about this, the ability to innovate, to be innovative. I think it's really, I think everybody going forward to being successful, you have to be thinking innovatively. I don't know how you train that. I'm not really clear. But boy, does it make a difference. We were talking with we were out to dinner last night with a bunch of German people, and they were talking about not having Uber or Airbnb here. And the reasons were not good ones, like because of regulation. I'm like, that's not good enough. Like, well, we have rules around taxes. They said, that's pretty good, but why don't you then change the rules to make it so that the rules are in place and yet you allow for innovation? Because, by the way, Airbnb and Uber are pretty cool. Like, it's pretty interesting for people to be able to do their own jobs and sharing economy. There's all kinds of issues around employment and how and healthcare and this and that. But can't you solve those? Like, the first impulse was to stop it, right? And so I'm like, why don't you create a sandbox where you figure it out? Like what's wrong with you that you can't do that here? And so I think really hard, like, around where are the innovative German companies? Like, I was thinking about, there's few, maybe one or two. But why are there so many in the U.S.? Well, this has to do with selfishness, that the Americans are selfish people. Another one has to do with the ability to break things. And sometimes they break things too much. Which one would I prefer? I'd rather probably have the break things and pick things up and figure out. But where do you get that balance between real ability to change and the negativity that comes with it, like what happens at Uber, like around that? Like, part of it I love, part of it I just hate. Like, it just leads to bad things if you don't check them properly. So I think you absolutely 100% have to be innovative. You have to think about innovation. You have to think about change. You have to think about I hate the word disrupting yourself. I really hate that. I think you have to think about changing and what it means. You know, you don't have to change, but you have to think about it all the time. So I think that's one of the key foundational, just any time, shift if you need to. And not just, and sometimes just to do it, just because it shakes things up. I think you have to be empathetic in a way that people aren't anymore. I think it's,
how can you train that?
I don't know. I don't know. It's just, I think about that a lot with my kids, like, in terms of, like, you understand who you are, understanding who you are, you know what I mean, where you are in the ecosystem. Like I always say to my kids, like, hello, rich white boys who are highly educated. Guess what? You have responsibilities that other people don't have. You have to understand the advantages you've gotten. I don't want you to feel bad about them. Lucky for you, like kind of thing. I don't want them to feel guilty, or I don't want to smack them around about it, but I want them to say, look, you were born on third base. Let's just be clear, like how you got to where you got. And then whatever you do from here is yours, but you have to understand your advantages. So, you know, I think empathetic thinking about what it's like to be other people is really hard. It's really hard today. God, it seems like everybody hates each other at this point. Like, you know what I mean? You know, I don't, you know, and the last one I think probably is being tough, like real being tough, like not letting people off the hook. I think our site, for example, it reflects me and others who work there. We're pretty tough on people. We're like, no, I don't think so. Or and very clear, but we're not mean. I think we're just tough. Like I was interviewing someone at Uber over one of the stories we did, and someone who did something bad, and they're like, well, I said, you know what? You're just bad. You just acted badly. I don't know what else to say. And they're like, well, you have to be, you know, don't you have to be non-partial as a reporter? I'm like, no. I said, I think you're an awful person. And you acted badly, and you need to do something about it. Like, that's what I think. And I think I liked that myself for that. I was like, you know, they try to, like, shove, you know, I don't know. They just, it was an interesting moment because I was like, no, I have an opinion, and I'm going to say it. And it's happened a lot recently around the Trump stuff in the U.S. You can't imagine how awful it is in the United States right now. Oh, everybody in Germany. No, you have no idea. It's literally like living it's living in vinegar all day long. It's incredible how quickly we have lowered our standards to his horrible standards, and we live in his world. You know, he sets the agenda, the horrible, nasty, prickish agenda that he set it, and we descend to it. You know, I think what we have to do is stop descending to it. It's hard, though. It's hard not to want to fight, you know, fire with fire, whatever that stupid press secretary for him says. But, you know, everything has become... it's really amazing how quickly you've descended into just his.
And it's only been level. 6 months.
You know what? I have a feeling we'll bounce back. It's like, that's why I think the United States has a history of this populism.
I do think so too.
Well, everybody does. Who doesn't? I think this is the worst of, and social media has weaponized it. But I think that at some point people will be like, just a second, we're better than this. There is that part of the American nature that maybe it's fake. I don't know. Maybe it's stories we tell ourselves. But I think there is a goodness at the heart of a lot of Americans who are just disgusted with this.
Yeah, I don't think it's fake.
I think it's real. There's something really great about America. At the same time, there's something really awful. You know what I mean?
Like every other place as well.
Yeah, but just bigger there. Bigger and louder and more. I mean, I'm sure, I can't believe you all must, I often go around when I'm in Germany or other places and go, I'm so sorry. I apologize for all of us. Like, I don't know what happened. I just, please let us recover and forgive us for our sins, kind of thing.
So. It will happen.
Yeah.
My last question to you, Kara, and then I have to let you go. Mm-hmm. We asked every guest on the podcast, this and also in the event series since 2 years, what is the piece of advice you would share with your 14-year-old self?
14-year-old self. I don't know. I think someone asked me this the other day because I was like, what advice would you get? I was like, I think I've done pretty well. Good job. Keep going. Yeah. Like, I don't feel like I would. I think someone was talking about my career and I was like, I timed it perfectly. I think I've done a good job. I wish I could say I would do something more. I guess I think I've done a pretty good job. So I would say just be the way you are. Just like be bold, like the same thing. It's just don't worry about it. Don't sweat. But I didn't at the time either. So I don't think I would correct this person. I think I was probably would have come out sooner as a gay person, but that was a different time period. So I can't really feel bad about that. I think, I don't know. I think I've been pretty good. I know I'm supposed to criticize myself. I just can't do it.
Great. Kara Thrisha, thank you so much for coming to the podcast. You've been generous
with
your time.
Thank you. You're a great interviewer, by the way.
Thank
You're
you very much.
You're very clever.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you elicit good answers. Anyway, thanks.
Thank you. If you liked this episode, then why not check out one of the previous episodes of the Role Models podcast? We have had conversations with people like Cindy Gallup, who is a former advertising executive turned entrepreneur
and a vocal advocate for more diversity in business. Or maybe Cindy Holland, who is the vice president of original content at Netflix, and where she talks about being a leader in a company that she's been with for almost 15 years. Or maybe chef and author Samin Nosrat, who just released a book about how to learn the fundamentals of cooking, and where she shares the story about how she just walked up to a restaurant carrying a letter and then left that restaurant with having a job. If you like to support Role Models because you like it, then please consider subscribing to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. And then please also post a really quick review about what you think, what you like about the show, and maybe even while you're at it, click on the 5-star rating. This really helps the Role Models podcast reach people like you, and also helps the stories of our role models reach more people. If you have any feedback for us, reach out on Twitter. We're at Role Models. And if you have any feedback for me, you can reach me also on Twitter by tweeting @David. Thank you for listening. Until next time.